Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry in the Diocese of Central Pennsylvania in the U.S., where we take a look at the lectionary from diverse and unique perspectives to help prepare church leaders for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and with me today is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello, everybody.
Hello, everybody.
Hello, everyone.
Wonderful to be with you both, especially after a little hiatus. And today we're going to focus on readings just before the start of Advent. This is readings for the Sunday closest to November the 1st. This is All Saints Day. And of course, around this time of year, we have All Souls, All Vigil of All Saints, All Saints Day itself, and that's what we're commemorating in the readings for today. They are the well-known gospel from the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount. This is Matthew 5. Jesus goes up the mountain, sees the crowds, sits down, he begins to teach, he opens his mouth and speaks in Beatitudes. This is the first extending teaching of Jesus in Matthew's gospel. This is chapter 5 through 7, the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, and it's 8 or so Beatitudes. Blessed. Blessed are they. And then there's a whole list of categories and classes of people, descriptions of people, descriptions of followers or crowds or disciples who are blessed. So that would be a good focus. However, a particular direction we can focus all these readings in is the people whom we know and love, who are dear to us, both living and departed, both living and dead, who are saints. And that indeed seems to govern the choice of Revelation 7 for the first lesson. We don't have any passages from Hebrew scriptures. Ours is not to reason why, just to accept the lectionary. We have Revelation 7, and in Revelation 7, John the seer, who is on the island of Patmos, according to Revelation 1, looks. And remember, from Revelation 4 onwards, we are in heaven. And I looked, chapter 4, and there in heaven was an open door. So we're in the celestial realms. And in Revelation 7, in this celestial realm, there's a great multitude that no one can count from every nation, all tribes and peoples and languages. You know, there's just a diversity of people standing before the throne and before the Lamb, robed in garments. They're just bright garments with palm branches in their hand, and they cry out together with a loud voice saying, "Salvation belongs to our God who is seated on the throne and to the Lamb." And this is a hymn of praise to the Lamb, the triumphant Lamb, the Lamb that was slain that now lives again, the focus of the description of Jesus in the book of Revelation. And the four living creatures and the elders fall on their faces before the throne and worship God, singing. And then we get several songs in Revelation. There's a discussion of who is there, who are the elders. But the focus in this section of Revelation is the hymn to the Lamb in the celestial world. So again, I think it can be coupled with the Sermon on the Mount, because the Sermon on the Mount is a focus on qualities of people and types of people whose lives are exemplified by the highest type of virtues. And here, one of these qualities in Revelation 7 we can see is the focus on God, away from self and towards the worship of God, hence this glorious hymn in unity. There is a psalm, Psalm 34, "I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall ever be on my mouth." The individual psalmist focused on the worship of God picks up this language of worshiping God that we've just mentioned in Revelation. And 1 John 3 talks about love. And we can do much worse than focus on love. The corpus of Johannine works in the New Testament. 1, 2, 3 John, Book of Revelation, Gospel of John are characterized by an interest in God is love. God is love, the characteristics of God. And in 1 John 3, the choice of the epistle for today, we can see that the focus of the gift of love given by God to God's children is that love is what we are. And that could be a focus of one particular reading of one John. So what should we discuss in our discussion today, my friends?
I like the ancestors and love.
Well, of course, I don't know, the older you are, the more... Well, that's not true of everybody. I was going to say the older I get, the more I think about the ancestors, but I think one could do that. One doesn't have to be old to do that.
One can do it at any time.
But calling on the ancestors, yeah. Something that I do.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds good to me.
And that ancestor, term ancestors, evokes so much. Traditionally, in my own history, when I think about All Saints Day, it's been in a mix of very individual terms, but with a kind of transtemporality to it, in the sense that I am so aware on that Sunday that, one, I'm remembering, at least in the Methodist tradition, I'm remembering those who have passed away this past year. But it for me has also been an opportunity to invoke memories of all who have passed away. That I can recall. So it's all in my individual sphere of people who have meant something to me going back some period of time within my own life. But when you bring the word ancestors to it, there is this much broader sense that pushes me into, or propels me, and I'm happy to go into that African sense of ancestry in all its diversity of meanings. And with those who don't interpret it as ancestor worship, but a valuation, that's such an old colonial kind of depiction of African ancestor sensitivities as worship. But as a sense of a community that didn't begin yesterday, and a community that has persons in it that are of valued memory to the community. They are compass memories. They are value memories. They are reminders of our own space, place in space and time, and a call to mindfulness about how we're going to live our lives and what it is that we will value and practice and commit to. So that's the way the term has broadened my experience of All Saints Day as I approach it.
Yeah, and of course, in our culture, it's not so far from Halloween, you know, where we have visible reminders in Halloween parades, for example. Not that there are any that I can go to in Maine, especially in a pandemic situation. Probably we're not going to be out there and about, but we can remember, as we remember our ancestors, we can remember past events where we've celebrated the meaning of life and the meaning of death. Let me just put it like that.
Yeah, and I wish with greater sense in my memory is also calling into our presence and our thoughtfulness the information that, say, El Dia de los Muertos, brings to us in terms of the Latinx practice of memory, and the sense that the veil is very thin and the ancestors aren't that far away. But it also, you know, I wonder, Josh, if you could also connect this to any sacramental theology, if that's within your purview, because it's certainly in the sacrament of communion.
Right.
That sense of connecting to our Christian tradition, those who have gone before. And I grew up with the term the church triumphant.
Right. I remember having I don't know that I have that much to say about the specific sacramental aspect of it, but I remember having very powerful feelings around this, or experiences of communion on All Saints Day after the death of my grandmother, with whom I was very close all my life. And I think that was something that, having grown up in a non-sacramental tradition and becoming Episcopalian later in life, was a very important aspect of communion in general for me, was the idea of the communion of saints, right? And the sense of the Eucharist itself as a sacrament of like an anticipatory participation in heaven, basically, right? But also the future, too, which is also an interesting way that these things intersect, the past and the future in the present, as well as heaven and earth, you know, these kinds of things that symbols like the Eucharistic symbols of bread and wine capture in this it's something that, when I was in a non-sacramental tradition, I always had a sense of, but I didn't know how to make sense of until I was in a more mainline sacramental tradition, and it was just that, it was this complex interweaving of time and space, which is unlike anything else, and which I think is important in the way that water and wine and bread are used in the church sacramentally as symbols of these things, which make those things apparent. And I think that's something that resonates perhaps more deeply at a time like this time of year, because it's kind of it's something that traditions or cultures around the world recognize as a time in which, you know, they talk about the veil being thin, mm-hmm. and things like this. Lots of movies or works of literature that explore this, the Disney movie Coco, right? The Day of the Dead, but mm-hmm. also like James Joyce's The Dead is set mm-hmm. on this date, mm-hmm. on the date of All Saints, and mm-hmm. Things like that.
I don't know those movies.
Wait, have you not seen Coco?
I confess with great shame.
No, don't. But you have a treat in store for you. Just think of it that way. No.
Coco, I must look it up.
Yeah, do you have any time off in the next week or so? That would be a wonderful thing. This would be a perfect time to watch it. You will, Althea, I guarantee you will love it.
Wow. Making a note. Coco, C-O-C-O.
Right. It's like, it's about ancestors.
It's about ancestors. That should be a treat. Because so many movies that explore the dead are about being frightened and terror and horror and scariness.
So the pandemic has forced many of us to rethink all kinds of things. And we were having a discussion about what to, you know, how to experience being together at this time of year. And one of our suggestions was that as a church group, our local little church, Episcopal church group, that we watch Coco together, you know, separately, mm-hmm. but together. So Althea, that will tell you another thing about Coco, that you know, it's possible for a wider audience.
Yeah.
Oh, you'll love it.
It's not a horror movie.
It's not horror. It's no zombies.
And you know, while Josh is speaking too, I thought about Hebrews 12.
Exactly.
And that mix of present and past.
Yeah.
I mean, future, present, and past that you're talking about. And I thought, you know, I have moved towards working with the concept of ancestor with that passage. And I know it's not one of ours, but just to read the first two verses to capture some of what Josh was saying. Therefore, and what I'm saying about the values and the compass, it's a logic of the passage. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, and that's what I think about the communion of the saints and the church triumphant, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us. And this is future and past, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who for the sake of the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God. So this cloud of witnesses concept that we can think with for All Saints Day gives us reason and spurs to live our lives in a way that has some kinship, some continuity with the things they espoused and the way they prepared for us who walk after them.
It would take a lot of spurs to get me running that fast. I love that you used it. I love that you used it. Because there's the illustration of horse racing somewhere in the background of that.
if not running. Yeah, right.
It's sort of an ableist kind of image. I'll walk.
Yes, it's also somehow such an inclusive image, because in our culture, it's all about me and my achievements, or at least it can be all about me. And look, I promote myself and how much have I done and so on. But this is such a communal image, you know, that I'm just one little aspect of some greater cloud of witnesses that is surrounding all of life and present in all of life. If you can just open up and be aware of those people. Yeah. And that's what we're called to think about. Yeah. Let's see. So Josh was linking this to sacraments, something material. So how then, Josh, do we do this in the context of a pandemic?
Well, this is something that has been very interesting to watch discussions around this, watch them unfold since the time of you know, COVID and folks being eager to get back to Eucharistic celebrations and not being able to, and then folks talking about, you know, what is and what is not licit is probably not the right word, but an appropriate celebration of the sacrament given its embodied nature, right? And I think I don't want to get too much into sacramental theology, but I think the embodied part of it is important, but I felt like there were a lot of discussions around this that assumed that people joined together through electronic means were not, that somehow that was disembodied. I thought that was an interesting assumption to be made, and something that's relevant to the ways in which we talk about the communion of saints, right? Those who have passed or those who are yet to be are nevertheless present with us in those situations, but not in disembodied ways, but in I don't know what the exact word would be, like altered body, like different. Their embodied presence is different than ours. And there's something to think about there, I think. You follow what I'm saying here?
Yep.
I think it matters, for example, that there's one cup and there's one bread. I think that's part of what the Eucharist is, but I don't think that that means that that one can't be present at the celebration of the Eucharist. Despite that, that's what I would have to say. But without us getting into, I don't necessarily know that we ought to get into those arguments, at least.
I don't know if this feels like a lament in me because what I'm about to say, because I'm not sure I can recapture anything that I grieve in this moment as we speak. And it's in a sense the kind of imagination that we bring, what the theological imagination and also our current imaginations that we bring to the sacrament. And to even to our memorializations, I'm struggling with this a little bit, but it's in many of the liturgies that I've experienced in recent years around this sacrament, what has dropped off is a sense of our connection to that past and those who have gone before. We're very present oriented in our concreteness. And so the notion of us gathering together around the communion, it's a gathering of those who can see each other, a gathering of the visible.
Mm-hmm.
And the those who have gone before are not part of our contemplation. And I'm not suggesting that this be a comfort in a really horrible time when death is presented to us with such force and such callousness that it's hard to bear. But we have lost that imagination, which in past times has also brought comfort. Maybe I hope in ways deeper, and I don't mean to trample on people's sentiments. I fear that I might, but I am wanting to point to something deeper that has a certain kind of reality than simply saying a loved one is now a star in the sky.
Right.
But that loved one is actually part of a body to which we belong. Mm. And every time we have the Lord's Supper, every time we partake in the elements, it's more than just a tradition that we're continuing, but that we are participating in something that is palpably present to us, palpably orienting to life, and bringing meaning that is not readily available just anywhere. And by having that piece slip, we've lost an aspect of our imagination that can be helpful in the kinds of times that we're going through.
Right. I think that's really important. I mean, because the whole idea of the real presence involves a complex interweaving of time and space and bodies not being just bodies as we experience them. Right. I mean, this is one of the things that in the debates and during the Reformation with Zwingli, it's just like, well, no, Jesus can't be present at the Eucharist because Jesus' body is in heaven. And, you know, Luther very humorously just would point at the altar where it says, "This is my body," and just be mm-hmm. like, "I don't know what to do, man." I mean, there's a certain sense in which a certain way of thinking about bodies only in terms of the material present alone in a kind of materialist way is doesn't fit with it's a limited or I mean I'm tempted to say like deformed Christian imagination, which is very important, I think, in times like this, and maybe an opportunity for us to reflect on in this time of continued separation and what it means to be bound together in Christ. I'm also reminded of something Augustine said in one of his comments on one of the Psalms, when Jesus says, you know, "My God, why have you forsaken me?" And some, and he's been responding to the question of like, well, how could God forsake God? And it's not necessarily a satisfying answer to that question, but it is illuminating for this. He says, when he says that as you, what he means is like, because you're part of his body. So when he speaks your words as part of his body. And I think that's also really kind of an extraordinary thing to consider in the idea of being, of all of us being, and the communion of saints being participation in Christ's body, which obviously doesn't mean just merely, you know, the historical, or as like in Catholic theology, we say the Marian body of Jesus.
Can you say more about that? I'm unfamiliar with that, the Marian body.
Oh, sure, sure. So I you asked me about this, about sacramental stuff, and I didn't think I had very much to say. But there are three ways of talking about the body of Christ in relationship to the, well, overall. And there is like the historical person of Jesus whose body, you know, was born of Mary and who lived in the first century and taught and, you know, did all of the things that human bodies do. Then there is the church and there is the sacrament of the Eucharist. And each of these have certain Latin terms associated with them. The two interesting ones are, you know, there's just, I forget the term for the historical Jesus or the Marian body exactly with the Latin term, but the other two terms are corpus verum and corpus mysticum, and the mystical body and the true body. And one of the things that's interesting about watching the way Eucharistic theology developed is that at a certain point, corpus mysticum and corpus verum switched places. And I always like to ask students what you think is what. And they usually always say, well, the church is the corpus mysticum and the Eucharist is the corpus verum or the true body. And it's actually the other way around. What flipped during the Middle Ages was the church became the mystical body and the Eucharist became the true body. But for the centuries before, it was the Eucharist was the true, was the, sorry, the mystical body, and the church was the true body. And the idea was that the mystery of the sacrament was that it united the communion of saints with the person of Jesus across time. That was the mystery, and which gave rise to and manifested the true body in both heaven and earth.
And the Marian body, that term refers to Mary.
That's right. That's
Mary,
right.
Who gives birth to Jesus. So,
right.
And by definition, you know, a wider collective, a wider corporate state.
Yes.
Is that right?
Okay. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I think it's also important that, you know, it's not just Jesus as an autonomous in person or something, but born into a community of people from the body of a woman, right? Born into the world from a body of a woman, and those kinds of ideas.
Thanks, Josh. I think that was illuminating and interesting and exciting too, to have those ideas arrayed before us to influence and impact the way we think about ourselves in the world and around the Eucharist. I don't think we want to convey the impression that the missing of each other and the missing of the in-person presence and the completeness that comes with embodied presence is to be dismissed. But I do think in a time like this, you know, when we need something other than our accustomedness to deal with the constraints or the restraints that are upon us and to think about this mediated way, this Zoom-mediated way or WhatsApp-mediated way or some other technological way of being together, you know, what are the concepts of our faith that that we have that will help us to understand things differently and enable us to stretch? And I think what you've been describing puts us into a kind of mystical framework where we understand ourselves beyond our bodies and understand that there are connection sensibilities that we can actually have and experience as meaningful and comforting in this time.
It's fascinating to consider that Jesus chooses not to be fully himself without us, right? Which is kind of part of what this idea of the true body of the Christ is. It's a Pauline, you know, it's a Pauline idea. Christ is the head and we the body, and the body include, you know, the head is a part of the body.
And how we're all knit together.
Well, it's both, isn't it? It's both with it. It's both every part of the body. Every part of the body belongs to the body, and the body as it's assembled then is the reality of Christ. But it's also that people have understood it, that the head cannot say to the foot, I have no need of you.
Right.
I just like to quote Paul when it comes to that image of 1 Corinthians 12. Yeah.
But this conversation certainly pushes us into thinking about the ancestors in ways that are more than an annual remembrance liturgy. And to understand that perhaps what we're being called to remember is not only the individuals who have gone before, who have been part of our community, part of our family, part of our friendship circles, but to understand the invitation to think about the facets of life, the modalities of our existence in ways that surpass, transcend our dependence upon material reality to shape and frame our imaginations and the things that we access. If I might though, I kind of had a quarrel with the reading from Revelation. It missed something, and I guess it couldn't do it, but I lamented that it missed verses 1 to 8 of chapter 7. Because that is almost like cutting off the foot. There's a piece of it that one has to, that we have to work through, because there the persons before the throne are organized into the 12 tribes of Israel. And the 144,000 are sealed out of those tribes. So there's something, you know, there's a way in which that feels to start almost like it excludes those who are not part of the 12 tribes of Israel. But then the dramatic shift that they're there, and then it moves to everybody, a multitude from every nation, all tribes and peoples and languages. It's an incredible vision of transcending unity that verses 9 to 7 bring, and it's around Christ. And I would want to eschew the imperialistic, colonial expressions of this every tribe, every nation ruled by the military might of a few imperializing and colonizing nations. But just to think of it as around Christ, that movement of peoples that are connected. And again, it's a thought of connection. These two are those who have gone before. And we can gather around in this body of Christ, our disparateness, mm-hmm. you know, our disunity and our strivings for commonality and unity. It just has, when I think about the first 8 verses and then think about how Revelation moves from that particularistic vision to this more embracing vision, mm-hmm. you know, then I feel galvanized.
Mm. So you want both?
Yes.
Yes. Yes, I get that. I mean, that pivot of verse 9, after this I saw, maybe we could read it backwards and forwards, because there's a way in which I saw one thing and then I saw something bigger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because the whole thing is a vision. I mean, Revelation is full of vision, and it's all about the seer seeing, and this would be a reflection of that.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you can see, and then you can see, right? You can't.
Right.
Yeah. Sorry, Josh. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, and I think it would be interesting at some point to look back over the lectionary readings and with the eye, and maybe this is something that we can take up in our meetings together going forward, the ways in which the lectionary readings tend to exclude Jewish particularity. I think this seems to be one of those moments where the New Testament is explicitly like linking this move to the universal messiahship, lordship of Christ, first to Israel, and then I have become more and more sensitive to that over time, and with the idea that we most all of us have forgotten that we are Gentiles and have begun to think almost entirely in terms of the fact that the gospel is centered on us rather than us being the marginal figures that have been brought in to the covenant. And that seems very important. It's something that is on my mind because I have been teaching the work of Willie Jennings, and he says that you know, it's this forgetting that we're Gentiles that it gives a foothold for racism in Christianity, for both anti-Judaism but also white supremacy, because we forget this, right? We forget that we are the folks invited into the family as opposed to the family itself. We don't like accepting not being in control. So
it's such a habit. I think it it connects in a way with the earlier part of our conversation. And I'm trying to surface that connection that I sense in me, but it's in the collective of all Christian history, and certainly both Western and Eastern Christianity. This is where the funnel thins, into the past, and our common trajectory is formed. In that memory, Josh, that we are the ones who were added on to a pre-existing history, a pre-existing theocratic faith, a pre-existing wrestling with God's dealings with humankind. And we have extrapolated, we have built, we have developed, but we come from that one place. And It's as though when we observe All Saints Day, we're called also, and I'm being I'm expanding here, called also to gather our amnesia, all forms of it, and translate them into real memories, because our ancestral past is complex and deep, and we need spaces and times where we pull it forward in our consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
Very helpful. So we could say to ourselves, or speak collectively, who are we not seeing?
Yeah.
We could ask ourselves that question.
Yeah. I was talking about love on Sunday in a sermon I preached. I have been influenced for many decades now by William Barclay. And although I don't use William Barclay and Barclay's commentaries anymore, I think I'm not sure. It could be in his commentary on 1 Corinthians 13, where he talks about love as unconquerable benevolence and invincible goodwill. Now, good folks, you gotta know that when I first read that, I was in my early 20s, all right? So it's a long time back to be remembering that phrase. That's how impactful it was. And although it might mean something different, it might have to be strategically used differently in different among different groups and in our relationships to power. The idea that love is not just our emotional positive predisposition to a particular group of people, but that it is an attitude that we can adopt. It is a tool, a guide for how we interrelate with others who are not of ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I've had this romantic engagement with it for all this time. And when I look at 1 John 3:1-3, which is where love enters into our discussions, I remember that 1 John is a polemical letter. It's a wrestling with love that is born out of quarrels, differences of opinions, estrangements, reviling, mm-hmm. but a call to love within a community, but peppered and inflected with a sense of God's love while we were at enmity, while we were God's enemies. God so loved us that God sent God's Son to be our Savior. That's a phrase that calls love forward as a unifying concept. In 1 John 3, as a soothing concept, when we have felt bruised, embattled, beaten down, love is a response, in a sense. And you know, when Paul says, when everything is said and done, faith, hope, and love remain, but the greatest of these is love. You know, how do we put this notion of loving the unknown? And I'm expanding the unknown to mean not only the stranger, but those who are part of that communion of saints. What is love as a binding force that crosses boundaries of time, of space, and of culture? Can it do that?
Why don't we leave that challenge there? Leave that as the way we pause in our discussions for this week. Is that all right?
Yes, a big question.
Yeah, yeah. But better to leave with a question than too facile an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you both immensely. And I wish everybody the joy of the Feast of All Saints.
Thank you.
To you all too, indeed.
Bye-bye, everybody.